Duarte and Angela Davis. At 11 on Between the Covers, we'll hear acclaimed author Dinah Megastu talk about his new book, All Our Names, A Love Story. And at 11:30, we'll hear some special program from WERU-FM about the abuse of Palestinian children in Israeli military courts and prisons. That's all coming up this morning on KABU. Coming up next, we'll hear a special hour-long edition of Press Watch with host Teresa Mitchell. Get all the news you're not supposed to know. And then some. That is coming up next on KABU.
Why not a woman?
KABU Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Sex Workers film series. The film to screen on August 2nd will be Mutantes, Punk Porn Feminism. Is pornography an acceptable form of expression? And if so, can distinctions be drawn between different forms of pornography? This documentary raises a number of questions, seeking to provide the answers from the perspective of pro-sex feminism, which asserts that pornography must be wrested from patriarchal control, and that in the hands of women and sexual minorities, it can become a tool of liberation. Again, that's Mutantes, screening as part of the Sex Workers film series, Saturday, August 2nd, at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KABU program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. One of the main reasons I do this show is that I noticed a shift in U.S. journalism in the 1980s, a shift that coincided with a general relapse to right-wing ideology with the ascension of Ronald Reagan and company. It had been going on for a while, I suppose. I remember particularly Ted Koppel on ABC News. I guess that was about, at least my aging brain thinks it was ABC News around 1980, ranting against Jimmy Carter over the Iranian hostage crisis, day 400 and whatever, you know, keeping a daily count on the nightly TV screen. As he blamed Carter for essentially being too weak to rescue the hostages, this worked very well for Reagan's team. Of course, now we know that Carter had sent in a special ops team that was sabotaged, literally. Helicopters were sabotaged by the Reagan team under Oliver North, but there were other signs important. I'm thinking of Stephen Kinzer, who had famously co-authored the brilliant expose of U.S. imperialism in Central America, the book Bitter Fruit. And so when I saw his byline reporting from Central America, I thought, oh, Stephen Kinzer, all right. But apparently he was taking a holiday from journalistic ethics by sending out the Contra War in the Managua Hilton and becoming a virtual stenographer for the vicious bishop, later Cardinal Obando y Bravo, so that the New York Times, with Kinzer's credibility, became the top cheerleader for that incredibly ugly piece of U.S. butchery. And then there was the swift and open silencing of the once proud National Public Radio news team over their reporting of the space shuttle program, specifically its subversion as a launch platform for the Milstar nuclear warfare satellites, and its program, well, and its destruction of atmospheric ozone with tons of chlorine from the solid fuel rocket exhaust. I remember a particularly hysterical article around that time in the New York Times about Soviet fighter bombers being offloaded in Nicaragua from a cleverly disguised grain freighter, which you can find in archives, 1984, the day before Reagan's re-election. Very handy, that story. Turns out that the planes being delivered to those darn commies in Managua were composed entirely of grain. As a matter of fact, they weren't planes. There wasn't anything in that thing but grain, a fact which seemed to escape any journalistic follow-up. So I was happy to get the opportunity to do a dissenting news analysis program. So I'm not surprised these days when I see, for example, that the news organs are parroting the nuclear industry's spin on the arrival of the death plume via undersea currents to the U.S. Pacific shore. Oh, good news. There's almost nothing. Don't even worry about it. The story is being presented as good news. That is, we are to rejoice that testing shows very little contamination arriving from Fukushima. And this is true. You know, have a nice Dungeness crab. Don't worry about it. Chow down. This would be good news indeed if it were not for the annoying and persistent facts, namely, that there was to be no testing and still is no testing from the U.S. government, which should have led the effort, and that, of course, it is physically impossible that the contamination plume would arrive in its fullest strength on the first few days after its multi-year journey across the bottom of the ocean. The realistic attitude to take towards the testing would be one of bated breath, careful monitoring, and I'm glad to say that Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and volunteers are going to be continuing their testing, and I'll be reporting what they test here. But the nuke industry would prefer, of course, that you just forget about the issue. Certainly, the corporate-owned press would be only too happy to let the issue die now. Likewise with Ebola. I think that there were many journalists and editors working once upon a time who would have noticed certain things that popped out months ago, specifically that the largest outbreak of Ebola in history has been killing medical workers in moon suits as it spreads over a wide area that includes transportation hubs. The initial reporting emphasized the soothing idea that the only vector was the hands-on funeral practices of rural African cultures. I think with the strong implication that, well, they were just fools. But the medical workers were dying nonetheless, and it had been clear for some time that the virus spreads much more easily than that. Now, too late for the vigorous and expensive measures that could have prevented its spread, we are finally privy to the more essential facts that the virus spreads with an insidiously long latency period and then hemorrhages its victims with a grotesque and incurable final stage, leaving by far most of its carriers dead in a pool of blood that erupts from every pore. And oh, look, it even kills intelligent, careful, culturally antiseptic, let's just say, white people. It turns out it's a completely indiscriminate force of nature, after all, and really doesn't care about our assumptions about who's superior and who isn't. How about that? So what is the vector, Victor? Could it reach a final pneumonic form like arithmetically advanced plague or influenza? It's not telling. Have some more, have some news articles on Ebola that I'll be getting to a little later. And this is going to be an hour-long press watch, I believe. And last I checked. And so I invite your calls and comments. I'll also be talking about the slaughter in Gaza. I'll be using Al Jazeera, the reason being that the Qataris news agency is the only one that is more or less pro-Hamas. The emir of Qatar has been in the West Bank, and I can't remember if he's been in Gaza or not, but he has provided aid, and so he doesn't... Well, the situation is pretty complex, and there used to be some support from the Egyptian government, or at least an attitude of support, and now that's gone due to political changes that the U.S. had a lot to do with. But back to the idea that there used to be some decent journalism about. I think there was a time when U.S. journalists would be grounded enough in science and general knowledge to expect the caution of scientists and outside-the-box thinkers that would see, for example, that almost all the predictions of climate disaster have been downplayed in scope and immediacy. Scientists do this because they're engaged in careful and replicable inquiry. The word science is from the same root as scissors. Information is cautiously dissected and never presented as speculation, not if you respect what you're actually doing as a scientist, not if you actually are a scientist. So even when megastorms hit, scientists are loath to label them as manifestations of the great global change. And that's a good thing. Scientists are not journalists, nor should they be. But a well-grounded editor A well-rounded editor would be justified in pointing out that climate changes are now occurring at a more rapid pace than predicted. One of those changes is the unthinkable global methane burst. It should be front page news because in its most extreme form, it could mean that within the next few years, atmospheric heating could accelerate to nearly unbelievable levels. Fortunately, there are a few such thinkers around. And I thank KBOO's Kunch for bringing the Daily Kos article on this to my attention. Here's a quote from that article. Vast methane plumes have been discovered boiling up from the seafloor of the Arctic Ocean on the continental slope of the Laptev Sea by a dream team of international scientists. Over the last decade, a warming tongue of Atlantic Ocean water has been flowing along the Siberian Arctic Ocean's continental slope, destabilizing methane ice. And that's the hypothesis of the team of Swedish, Russian, and American scientists. The research team will take a series of measurements across the Siberian seas to attempt to understand and quantify the methane release and predict the effect of this powerful greenhouse gas on global and Arctic warming. Because the Siberian Arctic contains vast stores of methane ices, clathrates, and organic carbon that may be perturbed by the warming waters and Arctic climate, Arctic Ocean and Siberian Sea methane release could accelerate and intensify Arctic and global warming. And continuing with this article from Daily Kos, he writes, Orion Gustafsson's blog post of this discovery gave me the chills. So what have we found in the first couple of days of methane-focused studies? First, they say, our first observations of elevated methane levels, about 10 times higher than background seawater, were documented already as we climbed up the steep continental slope at stations in 500 and 250 meters depth. This was somewhat of a surprise. While there has been much speculation of the vulnerability of regular marine hydrates, frozen methane formed to the situation along the Arctic Rim, very few actual observations of methane releases due to collapsing Arctic upper slope marine hydrates have been made. It has been recently documented that that tongue of recently warm relatively warm Atlantic water with core at depths of 200 to 600 meters may have warmed up in some in recent years. As this Atlantic water, the last remnants of the Gulf Stream, propagates eastward along the upper slope of the East Siberian margin, the program is hypothesizing that this heating may be leading to destabilization of the upper portion of the slope methane hydrates. This may be what we now for the first time are observing. Secondly, they write, using the midwater sonar, we mapped out an area of several kilometers where bubbles were filling the water column from depths of 200 to 500 meters. During the preceding 48 hours, we have performed station work in two areas on the shallow shelf with the depths of 60 to 70 meters where we discovered over 100 new methane seep sites. Researchers have on earlier expeditions documented extensive venting of methane from the subsea system to the atmosphere over the East Siberian Arctic Shelf. On this expedition, we have gathered a strong team to assess these methane releases in greater detail than ever before. And there's much more on that article in Daily Kos. So the number to call in with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Articles on Gaza and Ebola that I am anxious to share with you. And I would also like to talk with you about your opinions and comments. And David's on the air.
Oh, yeah. Hi, Teresa. You know, a couple of different things. You were talking about Gaza, and a lot of people don't realize it, but the when outer space got developed, this was just about the time the Soviet Union collapsed, that there became a law of outer space, a treaty of outer space, that they would not weaponize. And whenever they do these smart bombs and also the drones, they're using the satellites to do the GPS tracking, and that is weaponizing outer space. So that's a major violation of the law of space. And I think that that's part of the reason why the neocons are trying to deregulate everything, because not only do they want to mine outer space and turn, you know, privatize outer space and create an outer space economy that would create an infinite budget and also infinite deficits, if you can imagine that. But then that they would deregulate so that, you know, one mining company could then, you know, kill off their competition. And
what are you saying? U.S. billionaires would take advantage of us?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And as a matter of fact, if you just look
Greg Palast, who famously says there's no such thing as a victimless billionaire, but go ahead.
Sure. Well, if you look at the history of pirates, when all of the conquistadors got going, they were at first chartered by the king and queen, right? But they were basically, as soon as they got offshore, they were on international waters. There weren't really even any laws about international waters, but many of the kings who were jealous of each other would privatize, like Blackbeard, and I think even Bluebeard was had a letter of mark, if I remember right, that was the expression that gave them authorization to attack the enemies of the king and steal their property. So what we call pirates were actually people, they were private armies.
Private contractors.
Yeah, exactly. And so this whole idea of doing that into outer space, gets into a whole realm of whether or not they could then, put up their own laser beams and start attacking next sections of the world. But what's even uglier about outer space, before 9/11, there was a satellite system called Landsat. And, some of the weather systems were using Landsat. It was a system of photography, and it was looking at the clouds and weather patterns and mountain terrains and whatnot. And they figured out that they could actually change filters and see the minerals under the ground.
That was actually done under Skylab as well. I think we're getting little far afield, so if you don't mind wrapping it up.
Yeah, the wars of the future are based upon that knowledge. And after 9/11, they made that knowledge top secret. But if you can imagine, the Koch brothers already know where the minerals of the world are. And if they have a projection for 10 years in the future, they need this mineral, and 20 years in the future, they need that mineral, you can almost anticipate where the wars of the future are by the mineral needs of various industries. So, you look at Darfur and the telephone industry, the cell phone industry was digging up the minerals in Darfur, and they killed a million people just to basically get at the mining in that area.
All right, well, I'm glad you brought up billionaires again, and I'll go on with a little bit of news about that. Thank you very much for your call. Number to call, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187 from Forbes. Argentina's in default, everyone loses, from Christina Kirchner and Paul Singer's Elliot to Judge Griessa, and they write, things couldn't have come out worse. Everyone lost. Argentina defaulted on its sovereign debt for the second time in nearly 13 years. The holdout bond holders were left empty-handed, and the federal judge Thomas Griessa's strategy to force Argentina to negotiate a settlement with the so-called venture funds failed. Now, that's the way Forbes is going to frame it. There's another way to frame it, and that is that the Vulture Funds, and that would be Paul Singer, who is known as the Vulture and has been known as that for many years, bought Argentina's debt for pennies on the dollar so that Argentina could not renegotiate it. This is the same guy who was instrumental in destroying the economy of Greece. This is the list of this guy's crimes is very long, and he is very much in with the New York legislature, and he gets what he wants because he has billions and he gets billions by screwing people over. And his attempt to screw over the nation of Argentina has failed, and his little hedge fund has gone flat as a result. And that's the only good thing that's come out of this, is that his investors who have invested in his predations will suffer thereby. Here's another article from The Guardian Web. Argentina has fallen into default for the second time since 2001 after last-minute talks with Vulture bondholders in New York failed to produce a deal overnight. At a dramatic press conference in New York on Wednesday night, Argentinian finance minister declared that Argentina would not be held to ransom by the holdout bondholders, who are demanding to be paid in full on debt which the country defaulted on in 2001. And it doesn't say here in the article, but which they bought for pennies on the dollar in a very predatory manner. The way this works internationally is when a country just can't get it together, the way it's always been done is they pay a portion of it. It's sort of the international and more casual equivalent of filing for Chapter 13 bankruptcy that you can do as an individual. That's the way it's been done, and that has held the international finances together. There's risk involved in finance and more risk involved in international finance. And it's everyone needs to be reasonable about that, especially billionaires, in order to keep the system intact. And this situation has kicked the whole world in the gut, the whole financial world. And it'll be interesting to see what the fallout is going to be. This establishes a precedent for certain hedge funds that is very bad. But continuing with the article, quoting that Finance Minister Kisilov, we are not going to sign an agreement that jeopardizes the future of all Argentines. Argentines can remain calm because tomorrow will just be another day and the world will keep on spinning. Shortly before the deadline, Daniel Pollack, the court-appointed mediator, confirmed the talks had broken down. Earlier, credit rating firm Standard & Poor's declared Argentina was now in selective default. The vast majority, more than 90% of bondholders, agreed to restructure debts in 2005 and 2010, taking a big haircut. But Argentina's last default in late 2021 came after a major political and economic crisis. Scores were killed in riots, and both the president and the economy minister resigned, but there's little sign of a panic in global financial markets this time, as a default was widely expected. However, it could add more pain for Argentinians with the economy already in recession. Pollack said the full consequences of default are not predictable, but they are certainly not positive. So a number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187, and Christopher's on the air.
Hello. Thanks for your great program. And apropos of you talking about no good journalism out there, or at least in American journalism, Greg Palast just came out with an article yesterday, a great article about Argentina and what's happening with Paul Singer out there. But then I was going to actually comment on the climate change issue, and James Lovelock, who's a British scientist, talked about a lot in The Guardian and about how we only got about 20 years left of how you know reality to be now, because with the way climate change is going and with these methane, I didn't know about that from the oceans, but the tundra melting in the Siberian Russian area will definitely have make things pretty interesting. But yeah, great program, and yeah, they're definitely out there. Oh, and as far as the last call goes, they may be getting up to the space, but you know, the more concern, even driving around the greater Portland area, are these big battle wagons all the police departments seem to be picking up nowadays. And I don't really know what they're good for, since, I don't think we need a armored ATV to help bust down a couple of supposedly gang members with the big gang epidemic that Portland supposedly has.
I've noticed, to have an armored ATV to scare the crap out of thousands of protesters.
Yeah, they're all over, like Beaverton has them, and I'm just kind of amazed when I drive by where they store all the vehicles on Highway 10. You can see them right there. I'm like, what do you guys even need these for?
And for me, their purpose is very obvious. I mean, they might as well have it written on the side. Democracy, schmocracy.
Yeah, exactly.
You are going to do what the elite tell you to do, and if you rise up and try to take over, well, this is what we have to aim at you.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, we need a job, man. So, yeah, keep up the great work, and, definitely an interesting time to live in. And, what Israel's doing is pretty quagmire. But actually, speaking of Fukushima, which is like this subtle undertone of everything, no one talks about it. It's kind of interesting how Russia, the Soviet Union, thinks that Chernobyl was the biggest motivating factor for the collapse of the Soviet Union because of its big destabilizing factor on the whole region.
It was hugely expensive, and not only that, there's a parallel there with that reactor that is going to come to pass yet. I think I can confidently predict that the former Soviet Union had to create and mobilize a special army of people who went in for just a few seconds each to clean up some of the worst parts of the reactors, and Japan is going to have to do the same thing because they've tried robots. It's not going to work.
Yeah, and so, they're cooking the robots. That's kind of amazing. But yeah, keep up the great work, and hopefully maybe with the destabilizing factor of Fukushima, we might actually see some progress there.
Okay, thanks for your call. Sounds like it's breaking up a little bit there. Number to call, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. I received an automated voice message on my phone this morning, very early this morning. I was not happy to get it. It was from someone who wanted me as a Christian, which is, you know, more proof that it was completely automated, both in its production and selection, to support Israel's war on Gaza, which I'm certainly not going to get to do. It went on, and it invited me to press a button if I did not want to receive more messages, which of course would give them the data that I had received the message, so I wasn't going to press the button. So in counter to that, and I am furious about the slaughter in Gaza, I have brought, as I was saying, the Al Jazeera's view on this, and I've selected Al Jazeera because, as I said, they are more or less on Hamas' side. So you will be getting their propaganda as I read this text. Starting with this article, Israel vows to destroy all Hamas tunnels. Israel vowed, says Al Jazeera, on Thursday to press ahead with its casualty-heavy offensive in Gaza, irrespective of any ceasefire efforts, calling up thousands more reservists, and signaling no let-up until all tunnels used by Palestinian fighters are destroyed. And departing from this text already, and nod to my housemate, who pointed out that these aren't just terror tunnels. These tunnels are necessary for providing food, even water, all kinds of things, because Gaza is the world's largest, I mean, he didn't phrase it exactly this way, but Gaza is the world's largest open-air prison. It's surrounded by a 20-foot wall. You can't get in and you can't get out, and that's the biggest part of what makes this whole war so ugly is the people who are being shot up can't get away. And those tunnels have not made life livable, in a sense. They have not made life pleasant, let me put it that way, in Gaza, but they have eased the pain of the sanctions. They have eased the pain of sanctions that are so severe that the minimum calorie requirements of each Gazan are calculated before the Israelis will let them over the wall. There's this rage-filled and entirely misplaced genocidalist attitude, sorry to say it, that has hit that area since 1948. It came from Europe, and we know how it started and who's to blame, and I won't necessarily go there, but those tunnels, they weren't dug just for terror. They were dug for necessary supplies. Speaking ahead of a cabinet meeting in Tel Aviv, returning to the article here, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he was determined to complete this important task for the sake of Israel's security. His comments came amid a soaring civilian death toll and international condemnation of shelling that on Wednesday hit a UN school sheltering Gazan refugees and later a marketplace during a temporary truce. We are determined to complete this mission with or without a ceasefire, Netanyahu said Thursday. His comments followed that of Major General Sami Tungeman, chief of Israeli forces in Gaza, who earlier suggested that his troops were but a few days from destroying all tunnels used by Hamas fighters to infiltrate Israel, underscoring the desire to push on with an offensive that has so far killed more than 1,300 people, the majority of them Palestinian civilians and many of them young. Israeli military sources said Thursday that a further 16,000 reservists were being called to relieve, a similar number being stood down. More on this article I would be glad to pass on. This is from Al Jazeera. I'm inviting your comments and questions, 503-231-8187, and Barry's on the air.
Oh, hello, Teresa.
Hi.
Hi, this was from Joanne Hardesty, the show just before yours, and you must have heard
it. It was an excellent show, wasn't it?
It was excellent, and I did not understand. I did not understand why no one called in and asked and tried to find out why the people in it was Pakistan, I guess, why they were so against polio vaccine. Did they know something about this? They must have. People in other countries know a lot.
People in Pakistan and worldwide have reacted to the fact that the CIA and its effort to track the so-called bin Laden compound used a bogus program of vaccines.
Yes, but could they have known about this and polio vaccine and cancer? And if so, how That's what I'm wondering. If you got a little bit of it.
Well, I wouldn't say.
Maybe,
you know,
Joanne,
it's harder for me to answer that because, you know, just out of the blue. But I would, you know, the way I think about it is that people are suspicious for good reason of U.S. efforts, and you know, the vast majority of medical efforts are medical efforts. But how do you know? I mean, when you're in a context where, let's say in Africa, for example, where for hundreds of years white people have come and taken everything at any cost, when they come with medicine and a vaccine and they say, this is for your own good, well, you have a certain history to apply that against. So there's suspicion.
Yes. Well, this was Mary Sherman and her unusual death, and the FBI wouldn't give any information out about it or anything like that. And I'm wondering what, and it had to do with the Garrison case and President Kennedy and stuff like that. I'm just wondering how much cancer would have gotten into people through the virus that was in the polio vaccine, and why it was kept a secret.
I guess, you know, the effect of the simian immunovirus in that vaccine is something that's worthy of study, and you know, I must say, not the focus of this particular program, so I don't really want to go there right now.
I realize that. If Joanne Hardesty would call in for a moment, have a word or something. Yeah.
Well, I think it'd be worthwhile to read the book as well.
Okay.
Thanks very much for your call.
You're welcome.
Number to call, 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. And LJ is on the air.
Hey, Teresa, how are you?
Doing well, thanks.
Good deal. Listen, as a Jew and from a family of Holocaust survivors, Teresa, it breaks my heart to see what the Israelis are doing to the Palestinian people. Teresa, 265 children were like essentially blown to pieces. I don't think that children are Hamas fighters. I think if they're pinpointing their bombing, so they're obviously targeting women and children.
Well,
and
I think that
nothing but genocide.
I think that, you know, a lot of American Jews are very unhappy with this, and people are starting to stand up to the Likudniks and to their propaganda machine here in the U.S. And so let's hope that goes forward.
Okay, just a couple more things.